Okay, great. Well, it's good to be back with y'all, all y'all. I'm from Southern California, so I say y'all. That's a joke. Oh, that's right, I can't hear you laughing. I really shouldn't tell any jokes because I'm going to get zero feedback. How about this? If I tell a joke, go ahead and unclick your thing and then laugh for me, okay? Anyway, so this morning we had a lesson about finding Jesus in the Old Testament. And hopefully you found that to really encourage your faith. It definitely encourages mine. Then this afternoon we had a class. We're trying to, we're learning material, not so much that would make somebody think, oh, I need to be a Christian. But it's more like to defend criticisms, to sort of inoculate us in some ways against some of the criticisms that are leveled against Christianity. In terms of the reliability of the facts of the Bible, the history and the manuscripts and all that. Tonight I'm going to do something which is a bit more fun to me, because I want to spend some time just looking at Jesus. So here's the question: who is Jesus? There's a lot of theories about this, a lot of ideas out there. Some people say Jesus was a sage. Do y'all know what a sage is? A sage would be like, you know, Confucius, or, you know, maybe, you know, the guru on the top of the mountain who you go to for some wisdom. Some people would say that. Maybe, what do you think? Do you think Jesus is a sage, is a wise person that way? Some people say he's a prophet. Others say he was a liar and a deceiver. Others say crazy, like this guy was off his rocker. Not many people say that today, honestly. It's hard to find anybody today who would say that Jesus was a crazy person. Some people say he was Messiah, the expected one of Israel. Others say Son of Man. And of course, that label has different possible implications. Some would say God in the flesh. Still others, like Robert Price, and many, many on the internet will say Jesus is really a myth and a legend. I mean, there might have been a human that did a few things that's kind of sort of like what you see in the Bible, but almost everything you see in the New Testament is really just a myth and a legend built up about Jesus, you know, by the generations that followed him. Some people say he was merely a man, a good man, but a man. The most common view of Jesus, not necessarily in America, but in the entire world, is the last one on the list here, which is an important religious leader amongst many. So there's Krishna, there's Muhammad, there's Baha'u'llah, there's Jesus, there's Moses, and all these different religious leaders more or less taught pretty much the same thing. They're same, similar wisdom, similar ideas. Now, the question I want to ask you tonight is, who do you think Jesus is? And if so, why do you believe he is that you believe he is? Could Jesus be more than one of these? Sure. Could he be a liar and God in the flesh? No, definitely not. Could it be an important religious leader among many and a prophet? Maybe. So I want to talk about that tonight. I want to ask, what is a reasonable conclusion given what we know about Jesus from history, from the things that it seems that he said, the things that it seems he did? What is a reasonable conclusion about who Jesus is? Again, people say Jesus is, you know, Muhammad, Moses, you know, Hare Krishna, whatever. They're all kind of the same thing. Let's talk for a little. Let's talk briefly about what some of the important religious leaders in the world said about themselves. What did Confucius say about himself? Did he claim to work miracles? No. Did he claim to be a prophet? No. He claimed essentially to be a sage, to be a wise person. And if you read some of the Analects of Confucius, some of the things he wrote, I think you'd find yourself agreeing. He was a pretty smart guy, pretty wise person. What about Joseph Smith? Oh, well, there's Joseph Smith. What did he claim for himself? Well, he claimed to be a prophet. He claimed to have spoken to the angel Gabriel. Did he claim to work miracles? No. Did he claim to fulfill prophecies? No, he didn't. What about Baha'u'llah, started the Baha'i religion? Baha'u'llah claimed to be the last and greatest of the prophets. Did he claim to work miracles? No. What about Buddha? What did Buddha claim for himself? Did he claim to be a prophet? No. Did he claim to work miracles? No. Did he claim that God spoke through him? No. What he claimed essentially was to be a sage, to have a wise path, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path to sort of enlightenment. What about Moses? Moses claimed to be a prophet. Did he claim to work miracles? Well, that's kind of a tricky question. He certainly claimed that God worked miracles through him. In fact, what Moses said about himself is actually fairly similar to what Joseph Smith said about himself, honestly, and also what Muhammad said about himself. There's a little political cartoon there. I wouldn't show this cartoon in a Muslim country. It says, let me see. Thank you for your drawing, Billy. He drew a drawing of Muhammad with an arrow there, but now we have to kill you. All right, well, anyway. So again, like I said, the most common view of Jesus, at least in the world overall, go to India, Asia, Middle East, whatever, is Jesus is a wise man amongst many other wise men, sort of similar maybe to Krishna or Muhammad. And it's this view that there's many different ways to God, and they all kind of lead to the same place, different paths to the same place. You know, you can go, you know, up here is God, you can go there the Buddha way, the Lao Tzu way, the Baha'u'llah way, the Jesus way, kind of all the same thing. I want to tell you this. I believe that this picture is utter nonsense. Because if Jesus is not who he says he is, then he's not even a good person. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of ask ourselves, who is Jesus? And what's the evidence that supports the most reasonable conclusion? So first we're going to look at the claims of Jesus about himself. Then we're going to look at some messianic prophecies and how that reflects on that. And if we have time, I don't know, I don't want to go over an hour, we can talk a little bit about the resurrection. Okay, got it? So let's look about the claims of Jesus. And again, this idea that Jesus, Buddha, Baha'u'llah, Joseph Smith, never mind Joseph Smith, all kind of, you know, but kind of a pantheon of similar things. I believe that this idea is made to be foolishness. If you look at what Jesus said about himself. So as we look at these, we're going to have to decide if Jesus did claim to be what the Bible says he claimed to be, we're going to have to conclude either that he is those things, either that or he's crazy or a liar or a deceiver or something like that. Let's look at some of the claims that Jesus made about himself. Let's go to John 5, verse 39. Actually, if you were at the worship this morning and heard the sermon, this is where we started that sermon, right? John 5:39, where Jesus says about himself, he says, "You study the scriptures diligently because you think that in them you have eternal life. These are the very scriptures that testify about me. Yet you refuse to come to me to have life." So what's Jesus claiming about himself? What he's claiming is this. He says, the whole Old Testament was written about me. Now imagine how the Jewish leaders felt when Jesus said that. I'm guessing there's probably two groups. One who said, this guy is crazy. He is off his rocker, or whatever they would have said back then. And honestly, I think, call me crazy, but either what Jesus says here is true or it's not true. I know we're in postmodernism, it's true for you, true for me, but seriously, either the Old Testament was written about him and they missed the main message, or it was not. But if what Jesus is saying here is not true, that the scriptures were there to prophesy, like Matthew 5:17, that these things, that he fulfilled those things, then where's that leave Jesus? Imagine the audacity Just look around the room if you have more than one person. Imagine one of you raising your hand and looking everybody in the eye and saying, the whole Old Testament was written about me. How would you respond to that? It's like, all right, whatever, dude. Seriously. Jesus made some astounding claims about himself. And Jesus had a way of sort of backing up his claims by doing miracles that were kind of related to that claim. Let's go to John chapter 6. John chapter 6. I'll just pick it up in verse 50. I'll pick it up in verse 51. Here Jesus said, I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. The Jews began to argue sharply among themselves, how can this man give us flesh to eat? Jesus said to them, very truly I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise them up at the last day. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. And he said, whoever feeds on me will have eternal life. Did any other religious leader ever make a claim even remotely like this? Jesus says, I am the bread of life. I am the bread that came down from heaven. He says, if those who feed on me will be given eternal life. Now, again, forgive me for pointing this out, but it seems to me that either this is true about Jesus or it's not true about Jesus. And what if it's not true about Jesus? Then who is Jesus? Is he a sage then? Is he a prophet? How about none of the above? How about the most arrogant person who ever lived? Or, walking around in Israel making claims like this, all right, arrogant? How about foolish? How about suicidal? Crazy? You know, there weren't a lot of I'm not sure what I feel about this kind of responses. There were people that were convicted and people that really didn't like him very much at all. But what had he done just maybe a couple of hours before? What had he done? He had made enough bread and fish to feed 5,000 men plus women and children, probably 12, 15,000 people. When Jesus said, I'm the bread of life, he just finished miraculously making bread. Has any other human being in history done something like this? Anyone? What about Krishna? You know, I have a website and I answer questions, and I made a comment in the course of answering a question that Krishna is not even a real person; he's a myth. And I got a rather angry response from a Hindu person saying, "How could you say that? Krishna is as real as Jesus." And I wrote back, I said, well, Jesus, I know where he's born. I know where he died. I know how he died. I know the name of his mother, his father, three of his brothers, a number of his best friends. People who knew him directly wrote about him. What about Krishna? He says, I'll get back to you. And it was several days and he came back. He says, you know what, Krishna, he lives somewhere between about 1600 BC and 200 BC. In a city, he told me the name, but that city doesn't exist anymore. Okay, well, there you go. Let's look at some other claims that Jesus made about himself. John 8:46. Just imagine, again, maybe you have a group in the room here. Just imagine one of you, just raise your hand. Guys, I want you to know, I am the bread of life. If you feed upon me, you will live. What would be your response? You'd be like, ha, 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 very funny, ha. And they, what are you laughing for? He says, I'm the bread of life. You need to feed upon me. At that point, you're not laughing anymore, are you? You're like, this guy's crazy. This guy is. Jesus said it. And people believed it. Why? Well, what did he just finish doing? John 8:46. Another claim of Jesus. Let's go back to verse 45. Yet because I tell you the truth, you do not believe me. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I'm telling the truth, why don't you believe me? Whoever belongs to God hears what God says. The reason you do not hear is that you do not belong to God. The Jews answered him, aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and demon-possessed? What did Jesus claim here? Jesus claimed to have lived a sinless life. Has any other human being ever claimed to their contemporaries, to those who knew them, that they lived a sinless life? What about Muhammad? His temper was famous. Even amongst Muslims, his temper is famous. Never mind, you know, some other stuff that I'm not going to mention at this point. I don't want to be disrespectful. What about Muhammad? You know, what about Buddha? You know, I've read up a lot on Buddha. I know quite a bit about his biography and his philosophy. Honestly, I like his philosophy. But, you know, there's the fact that he abandoned his wife and kids in order to pursue this religious thing. I don't know. Let's just imagine, again, let's assume we have a group in the room here. I know you assume you have a group. I see they're in the Mackey's living room. All right, somebody raise their hand. Somebody in the Mackey's living room, raise your hand right now, okay, please? All right. Yeah, now tell the rest in the group that asked them if you're guilty of sin. They're laughing. Imagine me saying that in front of my wife. You know what I'm saying? Jesus, looking at people he'd known for years, looked them in the eye and said, can any of you prove me guilty of sin? And I imagine them going, there's that one time. Oh, no, not really. Well, what about that time? No. What did they say? Notice nobody said, well, there's that time you lost your temper. What they said is, essentially, you're crazy. Their only response to him claiming to be without sin is to say, you're crazy. What's that have to do with anything? I believe Jesus was without sin. Let's look at another claim of Jesus. It's just down the page. John 8, verse 58. I'll go back to verse 56 just to get the context. So Jesus says, your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. It's kind of following up on what we saw earlier from John 6, or John 5, rather. You are not yet 50 years old, they said to him, and yet you have seen Abraham? Very truly I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. At this they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds. What did Jesus claim here? Jesus claimed to be God. Did Moses claim to be God? I don't think so. What about Joseph Smith? Even Joseph Smith. Although his definition of God is a little shaky. The only people that I've ever heard of who claimed to be God were people in crazy places. And notice, it's not as if they didn't get it because they picked up stones to stone him. They picked up stones to stone him. Imagine. Now, I don't know. Again, forgive me. I'm a scientist. I like to ask these logical questions. The way I see it is either Jesus is God or he's not. And if he's not, then what kind of person is he? When he said before Abraham was born. He didn't say before Abraham was born, I was, which is what the Jehovah's Witness might say. He said before Abraham was born, I am. Let's go to John 10, verse 30, another claim of Jesus. We're getting the idea. We only need to look at a couple more to kind of see the pattern here. And I want to note, I want you to notice the pattern of the responses to Jesus. Because I'm telling you, in our culture, the most common response to Jesus is, yeah, he's a good guy. I mean, he's a really good guy. I mean, right up there, maybe the best person ever lived. But Jesus is definitely not that. Or put it this way, that's certainly not all he is. Because if that's all he is, then he's also God in the flesh. And he also lived a sinless life. And he's also the bread of life. John 10, verse 30. I'll go back to verse 29. My Father who has given them to me is greater than I. No one can snatch them out of my hand. Talking about his disciples. I and the Father are one. Again, his Jewish opponents picked up stones to stone him. But Jesus said to them, I've shown you many good works from the Father. For which of these do you stone me? We're not stoning you for any good work, they replied, but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God. Jesus said, I'm the Father of one. You know, I suppose that could have two interpretations. One could be like, me and God, we're close. We are one. You say, your husband and wife say, we're one, you know, like that. That's great. Or maybe he's saying that he's God. Now, how did the crowd interpret what he said? They interpreted it as him claiming to be God. So he said, you're claiming to be God. And Jesus said, no, you don't get it. That's not what I'm talking about. Not exactly. Jesus didn't correct their mistake because there was no mistake. Jesus claimed to be God. Last one, we could look at others. Let's just look at this one. John 11, verses 25 and 26. Now, throughout this, and as you read the book of John, you'll see often Jesus will stop in these different discourses and say, and what about you? And that's what we need to do from this lesson. We need to ask, what about you? Who do you say Jesus is? And what are the implications from your life? All right, John 11, 25 and 26. Let me tell the story here. Jesus was very close friends with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. I get the sense from the book of John that probably Jesus was closer to Mary, Martha, and Lazarus even than he was to some of the apostles. A very close relationship. When he came to Jerusalem, he stayed at their house. Anyway, Lazarus is very, very sick. He's dying. So they send some messengers. Jesus has healed thousands and thousands of people. So obviously, he's going to come and heal Lazarus. Jesus come right away. And Jesus says, nah, I'm kind of busy. I'll get there later on. Now, you know, from if you read the account, Jesus knew exactly what was going on. So he shows up in Bethany. And by now, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Do you know what a human corpse is like in a warm climate after 4 days? I think you know. Anyway, so verse 24, Martha answered, I know he will. Oh, let's go back to verse 23. Sorry. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, she replied. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world. So here's what Jesus said about himself. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. Not I offer resurrection, not I give life. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. And he says, if we believe in him, we will live even though we die. Jesus won amongst other religious leaders. Now, I'll tell you right now, if this is true of Jesus, then Muhammad is a false prophet and a liar. If this is true of Jesus, then Hinduism is false religion. If this is true of Jesus, so is Buddhism and every other religion other than Judaism. But if Jesus is not the resurrection and the life, then what is he then? Crazy person. I don't know. In fact, honestly, anything else other than it being true doesn't even really make much sense if you think about it. So what's Jesus do? Like I said, Jesus had a way of doing miracles to kind of back up the claims he made about himself. I'll tell you this, no one ever made claims even remotely like those Jesus made about himself. This is a fact. So let's skip down a little further in the story. I'm sure most of you or many of you know what happened. Jesus went out to the site of the tomb, and there's people mourning there. There's a fairly large crowd. And Jesus asked them to roll back the stone, right? Let's pick it up there. All right. Verse 38. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there is a bad odor, for he's been there for 4 days. Then Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believe, you'd see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of those standing here and for those of us right now reading this story, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, Jesus called out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped in strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. Has any other man ever done this? Has any other man made a claim like Jesus made? I really love how John finishes up the story here. It says, therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. Yeah, I think so. I could see why. 4 days, a disgusting, horrible odor comes wafting out of the cave and out walks Lazarus. If you skip down a little bit, some people, they weren't too happy about this. Verse 47, what are we accomplishing? Here's this man performing many miracles. If we let it go on, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who's high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. And basically, at this point, they decided to plot to take his life. Why did they decide to kill Jesus? Is it because they didn't believe he worked this miracle? No. It's because they knew that he worked this miracle. And to them, Jesus is a dangerous man. Who do you think Jesus is? Is he a wise person? Okay. Son of man? Okay. God in the flesh? Messiah? The resurrection and the life, the bread of life, who do you say Jesus is? Like I said, in our culture, the most common response to Jesus, that's a good guy, you know, I might even go to church, maybe I'll go to church next Easter. Or, you know, Jesus was a spiritual person, I'm a spiritual person, yeah, me and Jesus, we're both kind of spiritual. And I tell you that response is crazy. It makes absolutely no sense. Because if Jesus is who he says he is, the only rational response is either to bow at his feet, call him Lord and give your life to him, or to reject him, to hate his religion and do your very best to destroy everything Christians are trying to do. Anything in between is not really rational. So why do we have so many people in between in our culture? I think it's because they've never really been confronted with who Jesus says he is. That's our job, folks. That's our job. Who do you say he is? Again, the options are fairly limited. Crazy? You know, even his family members said in Mark 3, he's out of his mind. But What do crazy people do? Crazy people do crazy things, and Jesus did not do the things that crazy people do, other than claiming to be God, which is a little crazy, unless you actually are. Maybe he's a liar. But how do liars behave? The idea that Jesus was a liar is absurd. The idea that Jesus was crazy, again, is absurd. I'm really left with only one possible conclusion. That Jesus is the bread of life. That he is God in the flesh. He is I am. He's the Messiah. Now, next, I'm just going to go into our next little section. I want to talk a little bit about some reasons that I personally believe that Jesus is who he said he is. For me, the thing that convinced me first was when I read the book of John. I read the book of John, and I knew it was true. I knew it was true. But I'm a scientist. I'm a skeptic by training. So I needed some evidence. So I went out and did a little bit of research, and I started looking at the Messianic prophecies. I'm going to look at Luke 24:44. Now, the lesson this morning, it gave a whole range of kinds of prophecies, as you will, in addition to these historical prophecies, which are the most obvious ones. I believe the evidence that Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of everything in the Old Testament is an absolute slam dunk case. But I want to talk about a limited version of the evidence for that based on Messianic prophecies. Let's read John 24. Verse 44, he said to them, "This is what I told you while still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." So Jesus is telling his apostles all these things in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms, which, by the way, is the three divisions of the Jewish Bible. Basically, they're saying all these things that fill the Jewish Bible, I need to complete fulfilling them. In other words, he's saying, I am the fulfillment of all the prophecies of the Messiah. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at some of the prophecies and some of the fulfillments. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to purposely take sort of a skeptic's eye view of this. And we're going to ask some questions as we look at these prophecies and at the fulfillment. Question number one that somebody could ask is, well, how do I know for sure that the things that Jesus did followed after the things that were written about him? How do I know that? That's a good question. And the answer is, well, there's the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament that was made somewhere between 250 and 200 BC. So the entire Old Testament was translated from Hebrew and Aramaic into Greek around 250 years before the ministry of Jesus. And then there are the Dead Sea Scrolls. And at least a fragment of every Old Testament book other than Esther were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some of them as early as 250 BC, some of them 50 BC. And again, so what we can say is, beyond any possible doubt, at least 250 years before Jesus did these things, that it was written down, I believe, much earlier even than that. But we don't need to prove that at this point. And there's the column one in the great Qumran Isaiah scroll of 150 BC. Question number two. How do I know these things really happened? Maybe the Christians read the Old Testament. The Old Testament says that the Messiah has to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey. So they just say that he did it. Just make it all up. You know, that's not a completely unreasonable proposal until you think about it. And then you realize, why would these men and women create a complete lie so that they could be hounded and chased and jailed and most of them even killed for their faith? What were they hoping to gain from this massive conspiracy theory? And besides, we're going to look at about six or seven prophecies. And in most of these, the fulfillment of these prophecies are a matter of historical record. For example, Josephus tells us about Pilate, who had Jesus condemned to the cross. Cornelius Tacitus, who specifically talked about the Christians. and about Christ, the founder who was put to death under Pontius Pilate in Jerusalem in the reign of Tiberius. The Talmud, who talks about Jesus, and on the eve of the Passover, they hanged him. There are other sources, and I don't have time to get into this, but I'll say this, and by the way, one or two of the prophecies we're going to look at, we only have New Testament writers to testify to this. But most of these are things that are common knowledge from historical records, even outside of the Bible, even from non-Christians. By the way, here's the Caesarea Maritima inscription of Pontius Pilate. Sure enough, he was in the time of Tiberius. His name was Pontius Pilate and all that sort of stuff. Okay, question number three. Are these, in fact, actually prophecies about the Messiah? So maybe Christians are seeing what Jesus did and kind of reading that back into the Old Testament. Now, here's my response to that. We're going to look at, about seven or eight prophecies. All but one of these, the Jews said they were prophecies of their Messiah long before Jesus ever walked the earth. So we'll take it on the authorities of the Jews themselves. There'll be one exception. I'll try to remember to mention that when we get there. So if the Jews consider them to be messianic, then they're messianic, okay? Number four, could Jesus, wanting to claim to be the Messiah, read these prophecies, which admittedly were written before, which admittedly were messianic, and maybe what he would have done is say, Luke 24:44. Okay, I got to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey. Check, etc. Just check, check, check. And the answer is, well, sounds good until you start thinking about it. Because the problem is, in order to fulfill these prophecies, you have to get killed. And if this is Jesus' way of starting a movement to become a great religious leader and to set the Jews free and have people say he's amazing and awesome, there's a problem is with that, which is, in fulfilling these prophecies, all this is assuming some kind of a fake, right? It's going to get him killed, which seems to be a really bad plan, because fulfilling the prophecies involves a little bit of pain, a little bit of suffering. Let's look at some of the prophecies of Jesus. We're going to ask questions like, is this in fact a prophecy of the Messiah? Did Jesus, in fact, historically, we know, fulfill this? And could he have done this to kind of manipulate history in order to appear to be something that he was not? All right, Isaiah 53, verse 3. He was despised and rejected by mankind, man of suffering, familiar with grief, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised and rejected, and we held him in low esteem. If you read on, let's read verse 6. We all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Verse 5, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. By his wounds we are healed. And I've tried this a number of times. I've tried to simply read this passage with people who knew anything about Jesus. Even though they had no idea what Isaiah 53 was, they didn't even know what prophecy was. If you read this, just common sense. We know who this is talking about, right? So, now, is it a historical fact that Jesus was despised and rejected by human beings and familiar with grief and suffering? Absolutely. Could Jesus, knowing what was required, have arranged to be despised and rejected and to suffer and to be to have sorrows? Sure. How about walking into Jerusalem, walking into the precincts of the temple and calling the Pharisees a brood of vipers and whitewashed tombs? Yeah, okay, I'll buy that one. What about in verse 5 where it says, he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities? Now, if you don't know the full story of the crucifixion, Jesus, along with two others, was crucified. But it was the afternoon before the Passover. And it was blasphemy for the Jews to have people hanging on crosses during Passover. So they asked the Romans to end the crucifixions. The way you did that was by breaking the legs of the people being crucified, because if you do so, their leg would not be able to hold themselves up. You'd actually do them a favor because then they would die within just a few minutes of asphyxiation because they no longer could hold themselves up and they would suffocate. They come to Jesus and he was already dead. And they didn't break any of his bones. Psalm 22 we'll see in a little bit. So instead, what the soldier did was he stabbed a spear up into Jesus' side and blood separated from water came out, proving that he was already dead and been dead for a while. Now, could Jesus have arranged to get pierced like this? What do you think? So can you imagine he's up on the cross? Hey, guys, you're killing me. Oh, you're killing me. But can you do me a favor? Just trust me on this, all right? Just help me out. After I'm dead, could you do me a favor and take a javelin and push it up into my side? I'll be dead anywhere, and you'll do me a big favor. In fact, my friends, they'll give you a little bribe later to cover that. What do you think? Ludicrous. Jesus fulfilled this prophecy. And later on it says he was oppressed and afflicted, yet did not open his mouth. And if Jesus had spoken, he would not have been crucified. If he defended himself, they couldn't have. Especially if he defended himself before Pilate, but he did not. And again, could he have arranged to do this? Sure. But it got him killed. All right, what about Micah chapter 5, verse 2? Let me go there. By the way, that Isaiah prophecy is from somewhere around 720 BC, so 750 years before Jesus' ministry. All right, let's go to Micah chapter 5, verse 2. By the way, Isaiah 53 is considered a messianic prophecy even by the Jews. I didn't mention that. Micah 5, verse 2, but you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. This is absolutely a messianic prophecy. In fact, it was well known that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem. By the way, there are two Bethlehems in Israel in Jesus' time. The smaller of the two is Bethlehem Ephrathah. That's the one Jesus came from. And this is a matter of common knowledge. We don't know this just from the Bible. So if you want to claim to be the Messiah, you have to be born in Bethlehem. Could Jesus have arranged to be born in Bethlehem? Sure, if he's God in the flesh. And then there's Isaiah 9, verse 1. Micah, written in the similar time to Isaiah, around 700-something B.C. Isaiah 9, verse 1. Says, nevertheless, there'll be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. But in the future, he'll honor Galilee of the Gentiles, by way of the sea beyond the Jordan. What's he talking about? Let's skip down to verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Is this a messianic prophecy? Absolutely. Now what's it talking about? The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Now here we have a map of the promised land divided up by the different tribes. You can see the blue area is Zebulun and the brown area is Naphtali. That's why it mentions Galilee of the Gentiles. Now I'm going to go to the next slide, which is the same area during the time of Jesus' life. And I want you to notice where Nazareth is. Find Nazareth. Nazareth is right on the border between Zebulun and Naphtali. Could Jesus have arranged to be born in Bethlehem or to come or be raised to come from Nazareth? In fact, Jesus was known as the Nazarene, which fulfills another prophecy, the prophecy about the branch. See, in order to be the Messiah, He had to be born in Bethlehem. So you and I are definitely out. And not only do you have to be born in Bethlehem, which is down near Jerusalem, but you have to actually come from Galilee, somewhere in the general area within a few miles of where Nazareth is. And by the way, there's another prophet that specifically predicts Jesus will be the Nazarene, which is sort of cool. Okay, let's look at a couple more prophecies. What about Psalm 22? Psalm 22. This is from David. This is more like 1000 BC, around 1050 years before Jesus' ministry. This is David writing, and as we read what David wrote, imagine what David must have thought after he wrote this down. Verse 16. Dogs have surrounded me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. By the way, this is the only one of the prophecies we're going to look at that the Jews themselves probably would not have recognized as being messianic. But if any of them are obviously about the Messiah, it's clearly this one. Because the same one to whom all these other things happens. You and I both know how Jesus died. Imagine you're David. They pierce my hands and my feet. What did I just say? What am I talking about? Did you know that crucifixion didn't even exist when David was alive? Historical records say it was invented by the Persians, but even the Persians didn't pierce hands and feet. It was the Romans. Roughly 100 BC, who began piercing hands and feet and executing by this cruel method. And yet we have this prophecy 1,050 years beforehand saying about the Messiah, they've pierced my hands and my feet. If Jesus wanted to claim to be the Messiah, could he have had his hands and his feet pierced like that? Turns out for a Jew, it was pretty hard to get crucified. Because the Jews didn't have authority to crucify. Only the Romans could. And why would the Romans want to kill somebody like Jesus? They had no reason to. And again, I can count on my bones, talking about the fact that none of his bones were broken. And it says, they divided my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Now, like I said, most of these prophecies involve things we know from outside of the Bible. This one, I'll have to say, the only reason we know it is because John tells us about it. But according to John, at the feet of the cross, as they were crucifying Jesus, they were dividing up his lots amongst them. One for you, one for you, one for you, one for me, into four piles. But when they came to the inner garment, it was of great value, so instead they cast lots. Could Jesus have arranged this to happen? Hey guys, do you realize how valuable my undergarment is? Let me make a suggestion. Why don't you gamble over that? Because if you rip it in pieces, it won't worth very much. I'm kind of joking here. The idea that these are not about the Messiah, and the idea that Jesus did not fulfill these prophecies, that he's not, in fact, the Messiah that is predicted by these prophecies, this idea is starting to become not tenable, not believable, not rational. Okay, just two more. Zechariah 11. Zechariah 11. And then after that was just one more. Zechariah written around 520 BC, right near the end of the Old Testament. If you're not keeping up, that's okay. Most of them are up on the screen anyway. All right, verse 11 says, talking about the old covenant, it says, it was revoked on that day, and so the oppressed of the flock were watching me, knew it was the word of the Lord. And I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they priced me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver. I threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Now, what was it that Judas was given in order to betray Jesus? 30 pieces of silver. How do we know that? Because it says in the New Testament. And if it wasn't 30 pieces of silver, they wouldn't have said it. You know, because these things were written when the eyewitnesses were still alive. The book of Mark written probably in the 50s, maybe the 40s, possibly the very early 60s. So around 20, 25 years after Jesus' death. How many of you will still be alive in 25 years? Probably most of you. Probably nearly all of you. Would somebody forget the price that they paid to betray Jesus? I don't think so. I'm telling you right now, Jesus was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Not 29, not 31. I like to imagine the men who were there who pronounced judgment on Jesus. I like to imagine them picking up the Bible, the Old Testament, you know, I don't know, a few months later, and they're reading, go, 30 pieces of silver. Ah, oh, rats, we should have given them 100. I said 100. Well, I said 20. All right, 30 pieces of silver. Notice, the instant price at which they priced me, that's God speaking. God is saying, they betrayed me for 30 pieces of silver. You know what happened? If you read the book of Matthew, you find out. Judas came, and out of remorse, exactly why we're not sure, he threw the money back into the temple. They said, we can't take it. So they used that money to buy a potter's field. Exactly fulfilling the prophecy. At some point, the case is made. At some point, any other conclusion than the obvious here is evaporating. All of these prophecies made hundreds of years before Jesus. Almost all of them known from external sources to have been fulfilled specifically by Jesus. And virtually none of them he could have arranged. He certainly wasn't in the room when they picked 30 pieces of silver. Last one. This is in some ways my favorite. Let's go to Daniel chapter 9. Daniel chapter 9. Here, Daniel's been reading the book of Jeremiah, either Jeremiah 25 or Jeremiah 29. There's a prophecy there from Jeremiah that the captivity of the Jews in Babylon will be for 70 years. If you look in Daniel 9, Daniel's reading this during the time of Darius the son of Xerxes. We don't know the exact time frame. It's somewhere around 538, 536, 534 BC. At this point, Daniel's been in captivity for around 70 years. And the prophecy says 7 years. So Daniel starts praying and says, God, answer the prayer. Answer the prayer of coming to save us in 70 years. Now let's look at the answer to the prayer. It starts in verse 20. Verse 24. Not seven now. He'll say 70 sevens. Not 70, but 70 sevens. A decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. No one understand this. From the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, that's Messiah, Messiah, the ruler comes, there'll be 62 sevens. It will be built with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble, and it goes from there. This, if there was ever an obvious messianic prophecy, it's this one. It's going to put an end to sin, to finish prophecy, to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to anoint the most holy one. The word anointed is Messiah. When is this going to happen? 70 sevens. And how do I know that's 490 years? Because look at the context. It talked about 70 years, and by the way, the Jews were freed after 70 years. 490 years from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. When was that decree issued? Well, in Ezra 1, there's a decree for the Jews to go back and rebuild the temple, 538 BC. Then in Ezra 2, there's basically, he says, go back and finish the job. That's under under Darius around 518 BC. But in neither case was that a decree to restore, to rebuild Jerusalem, to build the walls. No, it was Artaxerxes. Ezra chapter 7, you can read about it. Artaxerxes, in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, which would be 458 BC, in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, God said to go back and rebuild Jerusalem. In fact, they did. If you read the book of Nehemiah, you see they did. So the most obvious choice for a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, 758 BC. Well, let's do math. 758 minus 490, negative 32. So that'd be 32 AD, right? Well, no, because there's no year zero. The counter goes from 1 BC to 1 AD. Oh, okay, 33 AD. Now, if you read the prophecy a little bit more carefully, it says seven sevens and 62 sevens. So, again, a more careful reading, which I don't have time to really completely justify. The prophecy says during that last week, which would mean sometime between 26 AD and 33 AD. In fact, 30 AD, when Jesus almost certainly was killed, is right in the middle of that week. See what happened here? The Bible prophesied when the Messiah would come to Jerusalem to be killed and to be anointed as the Most Holy One. The Bible says when the Messiah would be killed. So let's imagine, let's just imagine that some random person wants to claim to be the Messiah. There's a few problems with that. Because in order to be claimed to be the Messiah, you have to be born in Bethlehem, but actually come from Galilee, near the in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. You have to be despised and rejected, pierced, and crucified. None of your bones can be broken. The people who kill you have to gamble over your clothing. You have to be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. And all this needs to come to a head in Jerusalem, somewhere around 30 AD. How many people do you believe that have lived that ever would be qualified? In fact, really, logically, what would be the probability that any person ever living ever could fulfill all these? I'd say it's pretty much impossible. Jesus is the Messiah. The Bible is inspired by God. I know this. There is no other rational explanation. None. And I defy anybody to produce a rational explanation for this. What if people who don't believe this stuff? What they do is they just refuse to admit there's a whole case. They'll just try to take it one at a time and find an excuse to ignore it. But I'm telling you, it just doesn't work. If you want to do that, feel free. Now, I've already been going 58 minutes, and I really feel like an hour is good enough. It's just 9 o'clock. We're probably a little tired. I wish I had time to talk about my favorite subject, which is the resurrection. Because you know what? If Jesus was raised from the dead, doesn't that really pretty much answer every other question? What about this? What about that? What about this contradiction, supposedly? What about the fact that people believe this and that and the other thing? What about, you know, what about the, I don't know, people in Outer Mongolia or something like that? I don't know. Jesus was raised from the dead. I wish I had time to talk about the facts. Well, give me a couple of minutes. It's a fact. As much as there are facts of ancient history, it's a fact that Jesus was crucified in Jerusalem. Under Pontius Pilate. Got some evidence for that. Fact number two. This is a fact of history. From the very beginning, the church unanimously declared that he had been raised from the dead. Now, whether you believe it's true or not, that he was raised from the dead, you cannot deny that the church, beginning in Jerusalem, always claimed the resurrection. Fact number three, the tomb was empty. Folks, the tomb was empty. I guarantee you. Because if it was not empty, if Jesus' body was there, then on Pentecost, when Peter got up and said, God has raised this Jesus whom you crucified, end of story. All done. Fact, he was crucified. Fact, it was announced in Jerusalem very soon afterward and believed by thousands that he was alive. In fact, number three, the tomb was empty. How can we explain that fact? On top of that, 1 Corinthians 15:6, 500 eyewitnesses. Like Paul said, nearly all of whom are still alive. How many eyewitnesses does it take? And what about the quality of these witnesses? Every single one of them, you could threaten them with death. They would never change their mind. Compare that to, say, Mormonism. You take your Book of Mormon, it's got those three witnesses, right, to the golden plates. All three of them left Mormonism. All three of them. The quality of the witnesses is beyond comparison. I'd argue that it's virtually a fact that Jesus was alive afterwards. So what about the stolen body idea? Let's just say this. Nonsense. What about the swoon theory? They didn't even really die. Let me just say this. Nonsense. The only reasonable conclusion based on the facts of the empty tomb, the preaching of the resurrection, the fact of the crucifixion, and the fact of hundreds of eyewitnesses is that Jesus was, in fact, raised from the dead. If that's true, that brings us back to our original question. Who is Jesus? Sage? Prophet? Wise person? Son of man? Son of God, God in the flesh, liar, crazy person? I believe the only conclusion that even remotely makes sense with the information is that Jesus was who he said he was. God in the flesh, the Holy One of Israel, the one prophesied from ancient times, the Messiah, the Son of God. So here's the question. What are you going to do about that? And what are you going to do about the fact that so many people around you say, oh, Jesus is a good guy. Nice. Yeah, that's fine. You know, Hinduism, Islam, it's kind of pretty much all the same thing. That makes no sense. What are you going to do about that? All right. Anyway, I'm really glad you all came tonight. Hopefully you can use this information. If you go to my website, we've got a Bible study there that you can find that you could use to kind of study this out with people, especially about the Messianic prophecies. Anyway, we'll stop there, and hopefully there'll be some questions from the people who are taking part. I'll happily take some questions if there are some now. And, you know, it's kind of a teaching weekend from this morning, or even just a Bible question, whatever. I'd love to help out if I could. And if I can't, go to my website, ask a question, because I've got lots of questions that are answered there, or send me a question. All right, so what do you say?
Fantastic lesson. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
John, I was, thanks, good job. I was recently listening to this or watching this National Geographic special about the burial place of Christ. I wondered if you have any thoughts about that.
That's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem.
Right.
Yeah, it is a possible burial place for Jesus. We can't prove that it wasn't. Of course, to Christians, who cares? Because guess who's not there?
Right, right, totally.
So it doesn't really matter. But it turns out that already in the early 4th century, Constantine's mother, her name was Helena, and she went on a pilgrimage to Palestine and trying to find sort of locations. She was kind of superstitious, I guess, and so she tried to find the actual tomb where Jesus was buried. And this was her best guess. This is only about 300 years afterwards, so is it possible? Not likely, because Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. And then again, after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, it was destroyed again. But it's possible. And scholars who've tried to picture the most likely location, which would be just outside the city, near the wall, on a hillside, it's possible. I would say less than 50-50, but it's certainly possible. And when they've excavated in there, there's good evidence that this was the site of tombs, certainly by the 3rd century AD, and possibly earlier than that. And again, the religious significance to the Catholic Church, to the Orthodox Church, to the Coptic Church, for them, it's pretty significant. For us as Christians, you know, I just don't think it matters. But it is kind of fun to think about it. I've actually been in the church. It's kind of embarrassing because the Armenian church and the Greek Orthodox church and the Maronite church, all these churches fight over this thing. So they finally gave the keys to a Muslim guy because they were fighting about who could get in. It's kind of embarrassing. It's a neat church, but it's kind of dark in there. And I don't know. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions about that? Or is that kind of...
Thank you. Curious.
Yeah, it's got a fascinating history. And I don't know if I read that National Geographic article, but I've read others. And you know, National Geographic does some stuff that's pretty questionable about Christianity, but that article seems to be pretty darn good. I think they did a good job. And they don't seem to be hyper skeptical. All right, any other thoughts or questions, Bible questions, theology?
It does look like Annie had a question on when volume 4 of Church History might be finished. I now realize why Annie typed this message instead of asking it.
I've done almost all the research for that volume. Since I finished Volume 3, I've published 3 books. I have a book come out called In Christ that came out in March, a book on Hebrews. Got another book coming out probably around Christmas or so, group Bible study thing. And I'm working on Volume 4, but honestly, I'm doing a master's degree right now, and that master's degree is kind of... So I've written about 30% of it. I've gotten up to about the year 1800. I hope to finish it within a year. I'm telling you, it's a chore. I mean, the amount of reading for any one, volume of that book is like this much. And I've already read at least this much for this volume. So unless I die first, I'll be completing it within a year. Maybe within 2 years, absolutely, most likely. Right now, I'm leading a church and doing a master's degree, so it's kind of tough. Sorry about that. Believe me, if I hadn't taken this job leading this church in Bakersfield, it would have been done by now, for sure. But I got a job. You know, it's kind of annoying, but, you know, just kidding. The church expects me to do stuff like study the Bible with people and preach sermons, and just kidding.
Right.
By the way, everybody can turn on your speakers if you want. This is fine.
Go for it. All right. So this is Darren again.
Hey, Darren.
Yeah. What's up? So I've been taught that miracles were always done to confirm the word of God, and I'm curious. What do you think the purpose of the transfiguration was?
First of all, the transfiguration wasn't a miracle. And second of all, not all miracles were done in order to to confirm the message. Now, there's let me kind of answer more than one aspect of that. First of all, in Hebrews, Hebrews 2, it confirms what you're saying, that at least sometimes signs, wonders, and miracles were done in order to testify to the message. Let's see. Yeah. Hebrews 2, verse 3. How shall we escape if we ignore so great a salvation? The salvation which was first announced by the Lord was confirmed to us by those who heard him. God also testified to it by signs, wonders, and miracles. But Jesus didn't always do miracles in order to testify to the authority for what he said. For example, when he turned water into wine, that wasn't what it was about. And I believe Jesus did far more miracles out of compassion than in order to essentially testify to his authority to say what he said. But it was both. Great. And then the transfiguration, that was not a miracle by virtually any definition of a miracle. That was a religious experience. That was a theophany, as you will. God revealing himself directly. So why did he do that? Well, I don't know. I can think of two reasons. One is because Jesus was in a tough spot right then. So it could have been God helping his son, because Jesus was fully God, but fully human. I believe more likely, though, it was in order to convince the three closest friends of Jesus. But also, there's a lot of prophecy fulfillment, a lot of type, anti-type, foreshadow connection there. There's a lot of connection to Moses on Mount Sinai, Jesus in the Mount of Transfiguration, the fact that it's Moses and Elijah sort of making this Old Testament, New Testament connection. So I think the answer is complicated. It's multifaceted, but it was not a miracle. Yeah, at least not by my definition of a miracle. A miracle being something that happens, which according to natural law, as far as we know it, couldn't possibly happen. Something which apparently violates natural law. All right, next.
I have a question that goes along with that, the Hebrews 2:4.
Okay.
Because the focus there seems to be more the apostles.
Maybe, maybe not though. Yes.
I'm wondering if that has more to do with the Holy Spirit was doing this. To prove who the apostles were, to give them, to kind of credential them and to credential the whole message.
I don't think it's so much credentialed the apostles, although it did that as well. It primarily credentialed the message they were giving. And I agree with you that although it's true I did apply this to Jesus, sort of in a way, because I was answering a question about his miracles. But it, yes, I think you're right that in the context of what he's talking about, the message delivered to them, it says this salvation was first announced by the Lord, right, by Jesus, then confirmed by those who heard him, which would be the apostles, and perhaps some others who were eyewitnesses, and then confirmed, so the message that was being received, the written message, and the sort of the miraculous preaching is confirmed by these gifts. Yeah, so I believe you're right that in Hebrews 2, he's primarily referring to the signs, wonders, and miracles done by those who preached the message. That's true. But nevertheless, I think the point that was being made by, I can't remember who, that to some extent, Jesus did confirm his authority by working miracles. We know that because in John, he specifically says that. He specifically refers to the miracles he's worked, as because they asked, by what authority do you do these things and you say these things? And he refers to the miracles that he'd worked. What I'm saying is that's not the only reason he did miracles. In fact, he even did miracles which were not even for that reason. I've got a book on the miracles of Jesus. This one here, That You May Believe. All right, and I talk about the different miracles And I propose, I speculate, a whole range of reasons that Jesus did miracles. And some miracles were for one reason, other miracles were for others. And that's kind of a fun question. All right, thanks. I think I saw Sarah was going to say something. Is that right, Sarah?
Sarah just went.
All right. Who's next then?
Oh, can I ask another one, John?
Sure, why not?
So this was from my quiet time the other day, and I've never really gotten this one at all, but it's not necessarily about Christ, but Paul. In 2 Corinthians 12, he says, verse 2, I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, but God knows, was caught up to paradise and heard inexpressible things, things that no one is permitted to tell. I will boast about a man like that.
Yeah, Paul's obviously talking about himself. So Paul had a sort of a religious vision, not unlike maybe what Daniel had or Ezekiel had. Yes. Or John had, for that matter.
And so do you essentially believe, like, in a sense, he kind of saw heaven?
Well, I mean, he saw something. by the way, the third heaven, you have to put it in the context of Greek cosmology. To the Greeks, the first heaven was the atmosphere or the sky. And the second heaven, that would be the, we're in the sublunary world. And then the rest of the universe is beyond the moon. And that would be the region of the quintessence or whatever. So the first heaven would be the sky. The second heaven would be the heavens. And the third heaven then would be heaven. So when he says the third heaven, I believe he's being transported past the first two heavens, according to the Greek way of thinking about it. Not that the Bible's supporting Greek cosmology. He's just using a way to say it in that time. So I think what he's saying in his own coded way that would make sense to people back then is, I was transported to heaven. All right? And so he had a heavenly vision of what it was. We don't know. And, of course, this is in the context of Paul talking about his apostleship and the fact that he had a right to speak and they needed to listen to him because of the things that had happened to him. Pretty amazing section there. Then he says, when I'm weak, then I'm strong, and I boast all the more in my weaknesses. Right? I ask God to take away the thorn in the flesh, all that. So I don't think there's any reasonable doubt that Paul's talking about himself. He's talking about a vision that he had in which he was transported to heaven, if you will. Sure.
Yeah, I've got a quick question.
Great. Who's that?
You know, there are lots of different, I guess, ways you can read the Bible, right? As historical lens, a Jewish lens,
sure.
A redemptive lens.
Yeah.
My assumption might be that you love maybe the most the historical lens, but what would be your favorite way to read the scriptures?
Jesus lens. I mean, I love history. I'm a history guy. I read lots and lots of history. I write history. I think that's a useful angle, but, you know, really helpful in certain parts of the Bible, no question about it. But I try to look at it through a Jesus lens. How does what I'm reading here tell us about Jesus? In Bakersfield, we're spending a whole year just on Jesus. So we started in sometime in January. We preached our way through Mark. We just finished preaching our way through Matthew. We're going to spend the next, I don't know, 12, 15 weeks preaching our way through Luke. Then when we're done with that, we're going to go through John, however long it takes. Because I want to look at the Bible through the lens of Jesus. And I, to some extent, I do look at the New Testament from an Old Testament perspective a lot more than average, I would say, for sure. I definitely do that. So that's another lens that I use. The historical one, yeah. For me personally, looking at the New Testament through the lens of the Old Testament and looking at the Old Testament through the lens of the New Testament, that's pretty significant to me. If you want to think of that as historical, you could. Yeah. I've got a book on the redemptive aspect, just published. It's called In Christ. Might want to pick up a copy. Yeah. I don't know where it is. Here it is. Oh, you got it.
Yeah.
Who's that?
Brian here.
Oh, so did you like it?
Yeah, I've been working my way through it.
Great.
I love it especially as a resource to give to especially young Christians.
Great.
Really excited.
Yeah, and earlier this pandemic period, a whole bunch of us read your Hebrews book.
Good.
I really liked
it. Great.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, I got a new one coming out in a few months. It's just a practical one, totally not scholarly at all. It's going to be like a group Bible study, so something like 65 just group Bible studies. So if you're in a hurry, just pull one out. That'll be fun.
That'll be useful. Nice. Anyone else have any other questions?
All right. Well, it's Sunday night. People are probably trying to get ready for the week.
Yep, yep. Well, we definitely want to, John, thank you so much for
just
this whole day. It's been wonderful, and both from the sermon to